All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. Welcome to lecture. And it is April 25th, and we're pretty much done with the heart. We just got a couple things of the heart to talk about, and then we're going to move on to blood vessels. All right, but here is maybe one of the most important figures in the book because it gives you an overview of the heart and how it relates to the vascular system. All right, so here you see a nice apex. The base is up over here. And how many sides does the heart have? Two. There's a right and a left, right? So there's a red side and a blue side on this diagram that kind of underscores that. And how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
How many valves does the heart have? Four. So you should be able to trace a drop of blood through this whole cardiovascular system, naming all the valves and chambers, and tell me about the state of blood as it's moving past those different structures. So let's start here in this chamber of the heart. What chamber is this?
Left ventricle.
Yeah, left ventricle. And don't read the labels. All right, and what is the state of blood in the left ventricle? Oxygenated or relatively deoxygenated? It's oxygenated, right, because it looks red. That means high in oxygen. And then it passes through the aortic semilunar valve into the... What is blood vessels is here? That is the aorta. Yeah, that's the aorta right there. That's not really difficult. All right, and there are two sides to the heart. How many circulations are there? There are two. What are the names of the circulations? Pulmonary and systemic. And the aorta is an artery for which one of those circulations? The systemic circulation. And is oxygenated blood and looks nice and red right here. All right, and remember, a vessel that takes blood away from a heart is an artery. So the aorta is an artery that's going to take it everywhere in your body. All right, and there are special vessels that allow for exchange. And what do we call those vessels that allow for exchange?
Capillaries.
Here are systemic capillaries, and after the systemic capillaries, blood then gets drawn into blood vessels that bring blood back to the heart. Those are what we call veins, right? And a systemic vein is going to be what in terms of oxygen, high or low? Low oxygen, because oxygen leaves in these capillaries and then carbon dioxide enters, and then veins bring blood back to the heart, relatively deoxygenated blood back to the right atrium. Okay, and then from the right atrium it gets pumped into the left ventricle, but it's got to pass what first? The tricuspid valve, yeah, an atrioventricular valve. And remember, that is still blood that is low in oxygen. The right ventricle pumps blood then past what kind of valve? Okay, close. But it's going to be on the right side of the heart. Here's that pulmonary. And what kind of valve is that? That's a semilunar valve that pumps blood into this vessel right here. It's blue colored. Is this an artery or a vein? It's an artery because it's taking blood away from the heart. It's blue because it's part of the pulmonary circulation, right? So then the pulmonary arteries bring blood to capillaries for exchange in the lungs. Oxygen goes in, CO2 goes out, and then here's a nice bright red blood vessel, meaning what? It's oxygenated. And what kind of vessel is this, artery or vein? It's a vein because it's in the pulmonary circulation, which brings blood to the left atrium. Left atrium pumps blood past a valve, which is the mitral valve or bicuspid valve, into the left atrium. That's where we started. So that's what we drew out on the board last time. You guys made some really nice notes. So make sure you can draw that figure out. Okay, as part of the pre-lecture reading assignment. All right, we talked about, I'm over on the other side. We talked about conduction system of the heart. These are specialized, okay, specialized muscle cells that don't contract, but they carry electrical information. They're a lot like nerves. And in a physiology class, you'll see, understand why those muscle cells, and indeed all muscle cells, sort of act like nerves. They can carry electrical information over the cell membrane. Right? And there's one special area inside the heart where the electrical properties of the heart are autorhythmic, right? That they just automatically will cause electrical signals to develop periodically, and so it's the pacemaker of the heart, and it controls the heart rhythm, and it's in the right atrium, right about at the orifice at the superior vena cava. That's called the sinoatrial node. And that electricity, those electrical signals, can flow from one myocardial cell to the next because the intercalated discs have a special kind of junction. What do we call that junction?
Gap.
They're gap junctions, right? So here is an intercalated disc, and there are pores that allow for that electrical activity to move from one cell to the neighboring cell. And these cells are branched, so that electrical signal not only travels from right to left, but it goes from the superior surface to deep inside the heart, stimulating the whole heart as a unit. Okay, the gap junctions allow the transfer of that electrical signal. Okay, so in terms of the conduction system of the heart, where do we have it? Oh, here it is right here. Okay, so you have this, the SA node right here. Electrical signals travel through the myocardium of the atrial myocardium to the atrioventricular node, right? Then down into the AV bundle, atrial ventricular bundle. That's the only way electrical signals can get through the fibrous skeleton of the heart, because the fibrous skeleton of the heart is just connective tissue. These electrical signals can't get into the ventricle, only via the AV bundle. Then the AV bundle sends signals to the bundle branches in the interventricular septum, and they zip down to the apex of the heart very, very quickly. And then that electrical signal is distributed throughout the myocardium via these Purkinje fibers. All right, so it's the apex that contracts. Okay, in terms of the ventricles, the apex contracts first compared to these basal regions of the ventricles. All right, but what's really the first part of the heart that contracts? What part gets the electrical stimulus first? So the electrical stimulus is not analogous to contraction, but it signals contraction. What part signals contraction first? First, it's the right atrium. That's right. The right atrium and the right and the left atrium contract together because that electrical signal moves very, very quickly through both atria. So both atria contract, pump blood into the ventricles, and then both ventricles contract together, forcing blood up from the apex toward the base of the heart and then out the aorta and out the pulmonary artery. And the reason why the heart works like that is because of this structure of the conducting system inside the heart. That's pretty important to know about. All right, sometimes the electrical signal, okay, doesn't travel, just like we said, from the SA node to the AV node, AV bundle, down through the bundle branches. Because, remember, each of these cells that make up the myocardium can transmit electrical information. And every once in a while, there might be some electrical information in the left ventricle that starts to take its own way around the heart. And it might actually start to circle the heart in a circle or move from the base to the apex and then back up and then circle the heart once again. All right, and what does that electrical signal do? It signals contraction, so the heart then is just going to sit in one spot. It's not going to contract and pump blood, but it's just going to quiver. The whole heart is going to contract, but not in a coordinated fashion. It's just going to kind of quiver, and when that muscle's contracting, it's using up ATP, so that's a detrimental to the heart. And since the heart is just quivering, it's not pumping blood. That condition is what we call fibrillation. No coordinated contraction because the synchronized depolarization or that synchronized electrical signal is lost as a result of that. And so the heart just sits there, uses up energy, blood is not being pumped to the brain. Then how long do you have to maintain consciousness if the heart isn't pumping blood? Blood isn't reaching the brain. We talked about this maybe a couple times. Seconds, yeah, 2 to 3 seconds. You lose consciousness, all right? And don't forget, what's the really bad thing? The brain is going to die if it doesn't have oxygen. How long do you have to get blood flow reestablished to the brain? Okay? Again, use maybe 2 to 3 minutes. Some people, of course, might last a little bit longer. You can do CPR on them, chest compressions and things like that. And as a matter of fact, if it's for me personally, think that my brain can live for an hour before it dies, right? So don't stop doing CPR on me because my brain still might be alive for an hour, okay? So, of course, that's not really true, but you should never really stop doing CPR on somebody until professional people arrive, right, to take over, because you just never know. Okay, so that's the heart and the conduction system. Let's talk about innervation to the heart. Because there's an SA node right here, the heart is going to contract all by itself, even if there are no nerve fibers going to it, because the heart is autorhythmic. Right? There are nerve fibers that go to the heart, and they just adjust the rhythm of the heart and the force of contraction. Okay, and so what kind of nerve fibers go to the heart? Voluntary somatic nerve fibers or autonomic fibers? Autonomic fibers. And you should know, how many divisions are there to the autonomic nervous system? Yeah, there are two, right? So you got the parasympathetic and the sympathetic. How would you describe the relationship between parasympathetic and sympathetic? Just in relationship to each other. Oh, I heard it back there. Somebody said they're antagonistic to each other. Okay? So one will speed up the heart rate and the other division will slow it down. So we have to learn which one does which. The parasympathetic nervous system, right, via the vagus nerve. Anybody remember what cranial nerve the vagus nerve is? That's number 10. If you want to know one, that's one to know for sure. Okay? Will inhibit the SA node, will slow down its intrinsic rate of depolarization. And so it will slow the heart rate down. So anytime you think of rate, you think of time, and you can wear an instrument on your wrist that will measure time for you. What do we call that instrument on your wrist? You call it a wrist watch sometimes, but it's also known as especially if you buy a really expensive one, they don't say wrist watch, they call it a chronograph, okay? Anytime you hear this word chrono, you should think of time or rate. So, in terms of the parasympathetic nervous system, it has a chronotropic effect on the heart. It adjusts the heart rate. And which way does it adjust the heart rate? It slows it down. It inhibits the heart, right? So, we say that the parasympathetic nervous system has a cardioinhibitory effect on the heart, or a negative chronotropic effect. It will slow the heart rate down. All right, so if the parasympathetic has a negative chronotropic effect on the heart, what nervous system will have a positive chronotropic effect on the heart? The sympathetic nervous system, because they're antagonistic, right? So sympathetic fibers from the cardioaccelerator center in the medulla, okay, will go to the SA node, will increase heart rate because it has a positive chronotropic effect on the heart. There are also sympathetic nerve fibers that go to the ventricle muscles and will cause the muscles of the heart to contract with more force, right? And when the sympathetic nervous system is stimulated, your heartbeat will get stronger. You'll feel it pounding in your chest. And if you ever live through an episode where for sure you think you're going to die, like maybe you're driving down the freeway and you're between two semi-tractor trailers and then all of a sudden one decides to switch into your lane, doesn't see you, starts to move over and you're going to get squished between these two big trucks and there's no way out of it, you think you're going to die, guess what happens to your heart? Stimulated with the sympathetic nervous system, it speeds up, but that's not the only other thing. The force of contraction also increases, and it's going to feel like it's just pounding right outside your chest, right? So both the rate and force of contraction will increase. And that force of contraction is what we call an inotropic effect. So the sympathetic nervous system is a positive chronotropic agent and a positive inotropic agent. It affects both the force of contraction and the rate of contraction. Here's the funny thing. Parasympathetic nerves only go to the SA node and AV node right here, so it can only affect heart rate. Parasympathetic nerves don't go to the ventricle, so they cannot affect the force of contraction. So that's something different between the parasympathetic and sympathetics. Parasympathetic can only affect heart rate, but the sympathetic can affect heart rate plus force of contraction as a result of that. So it's good to know your cardiology, and a good place to know that is by knowing your anatomy. Okay, let's see. Well, I think there was something else I wanted to talk about, but that's it for this chapter. I guess I'll talk about it in terms of the vascular system, which is what we're going to look at next. Oh yeah, how does blood return to the heart? Well, it's via veins. We'll look and see what the process is that allows blood to return to the heart. in that next chapter. Okay, and that next chapter is, I have it opened up right here. Where do I want to put it? I think I'm going to slide it over here so you can't see it. Ah, here it is. Okay. So it is circulatory system. Where is it? I think I just better get rid of that one. Sure, I'll save changes. Looking a little strange. All right, let me get this window open as big as I can get it. Okay, so this is circulation chapter. And the first thing that we want to look at in circulation are the layers that make up a blood vessel. So let's look at some pictures of layers of blood vessels. Right here. And so remember, this is kind of a blast from the past. Where did you have to learn a lot of layers? In the skin, for instance. Remember all the layers in the skin? And how important they were to understand the job that the skin is doing for us? Okay, so here is a nice picture in your book, probably an exam figure, that shows the three main layers of a blood vessel. And let's take a look at these blood vessels first. Okay, over here, we see a blood vessel, and this blood vessel is taking blood away from the heart, so the heart is going to be superior to this diagram. It's taking blood away from the heart. What do we call a vessel taking blood away from the heart? That's an artery, and we see it labeled right here. The center part of this artery is what we call the lumen. What's in the lumen of an artery? Blood, right? So that's just the center of this tube. And you can see this tube is what? Pretty thick or pretty thin?
Thin.
Okay. Here is the lumen. The wall of the blood vessel starts here, and I got one layer, two, three, four, five, six, seven layers right here. So you know what? I consider this a pretty thick blood vessel. It's thick. All right. The next kind of blood vessel that we have is one that brings blood back to the heart. And that is what we call a vein. Okay, and so we have an artery and a vein, and we have a red arrow in the artery, we have a blue arrow in the vein. Okay, but remember, we can't remember arteries and veins by the color of blood in there, but if we know the color, we can say what circulation it belongs to. So if we look at this diagram, and if we have red blood in an artery and blue blood in a vein, what circulation is this depicting? Yeah, what are the two circulations? You got systemic and pulmonary. Which one is this diagram right here? It's systemic, because in systemic circulation, you have oxygenated blood in arteries and relatively deoxygenated blood in the veins, right? So I'm really hammering that point home for you. Hopefully you see that nice and clear right now. The third kind of blood vessel that we have is a capillary. And a capillary is, we see, here is the wall of the capillary. So I only see two layers right here. So is a capillary thick or thin compared to an artery and a vein? It's thin. And indeed, that's how I want you to know that. Because a capillary is so thin, it allows for exchange of material from the lumen of this vessel to the extracellular space or interstitial space. All right, so we got arteries, capillaries, and veins. Let's look at the three main layers that we find in these blood vessels: the tunica intima, the tunica media, and the tunica externa. And tunic just means a coat or a covering. All right, so when you put on a sweater, that's a tunic. You put on a coat, that's a tunic that surrounds your body. The tunica intima right here, which is the innermost layer, right, is composed of an endothelium. All right, an endothelium is just a fancy name for epithelium that's lining the interior surface of some cavity, right? So it's an epithelium. And what do you know about epitheliums? You know how to characterize it by shape of the cells and number of layers. All right, so what does this look like right here? How many layers does it look like? One. What do we call an epithelium with one layer? Simple. So here is a simple epithelium that's lining this blood vessel. We call it an endothelium because of that. And what are the shape of these cells? Yeah, they're squamous. So an endothelium is just a simple squamous epithelium that lines a blood vessel and It's not very thick, but it's designed to be slippery and smooth and prevent blood clots. That's why it's there. So blood can flow over it very nicely. All right, another part of the tunica intima, intima just means what, the internal layer, is the subendothelial layer of connective tissue right here that connects the endothelium to some elastic tissue. All right, and what's the cool thing about elastic tissue? It can stretch, right? It's designed to stretch. It can get bigger, and then after that tension disappears, what happens to elastic tissue? It goes back to its original shape. So that when the heart pumps a bunch of blood into an artery, it can actually expand, it can stretch. And then after that big bolus of blood goes through that artery, what happens to the artery? It goes back down to its normal size once again. All right, so there is some elastic tissue in the tunica intima. But that elastic tissue is not strong enough to prevent bursting of this blood vessel, because in an artery, there can be very high pressures. Okay, there could be over 100 millimeters of mercury of pressure in here. And normally it's about 120, and in people that have high blood pressure, it could be 190 millimeters of mercury, which is enough for blood to squirt out of an artery to maybe even hit that wall over there. All right, so there's a lot of pressure inside arteries. This elastic tissue can't hold arteries together, so there are muscles. And here is smooth muscle. We don't have skeletal muscle in arteries. And this is the kind of tissue, the smooth muscle right here, that can hold that high pressure and keep it inside this blood vessel so that it doesn't burst. All right, and then there's some more elastic tissue in the tunica media. So there's circular smooth muscle and elastic tissue. And different kinds of arteries have different amounts of elastic tissue. Arteries that are close to the heart have more elastic tissue, elastic tissue compared to arteries that are far away from the heart. So the aorta can expand a lot and then go back down to its normal diameter. And then the tunica externa right here it's a connective tissue with a lot of collagen fibers. And remember, collagen is a very tough fiber. And again, that protects his blood vessel from bursting. So arteries are very thick. Capillaries are really thin. They only have an endothelial layer and a very thin basement membrane that connects it to the interstitial space. So this is where exchange can take place. Exchange cannot take place in an artery because material would have to move across all these layers right here. And it's just impossible to do that. So if you have oxygen in an artery, okay, and that blood isn't moving, guess where that oxygen is going to stay? So here you have an artery, it's oxygenated, and if the blood isn't moving, where is that oxygen going to stay? Is it going to leak out? It can't leak out. It's going to stay in that blood right here. Okay, and those of you that are CPR certified, I know some of you are, you might have noticed that they changed the guidelines for CPR for resuscitating somebody, and they cut back on the number of breaths compared to chest compressions, right? And the reason was because when somebody's heart isn't breathing, all their arteries are loaded with oxygen, but it's stuck right there. What do you want to do? You want to do chest compressions to get that blood moving to the brain and to the heart so that that oxygen that's in the arteries can be released to the brain to protect the brain. So you still do respirations, but in the last couple of years, the number of respirations to heart pumps was greatly reduced, right? It's more important to get this blood moving by doing chest compressions because this arterial supply is loaded with oxygen. That's more important. All right, then in exchange, you have oxygen going out, CO2 going in, blood is relatively deoxygenated, looks blue, and it gets into this vein, and it goes back to the heart. A vein has the same number of layers. It has an intima, media, and externa, but the components of these layers changes a little bit. There's very low pressure in a vein. And as a result, the muscle layer of the tunica media is much smaller. All right, so the vein is not very strong, and it can actually collapse. Right, since it has low pressure, you can see it kind of dimpling in right here. So it can form folds. It still has an endothelium because we want blood to slip and slide back to the heart. Okay, it has a little bit of smooth muscle that can contract and relax a little bit. The tunica externa is pretty much the same. All right, but the smooth muscle layer is not as thick and doesn't have as much elastic property compared to arteries because it's very low pressure. The other thing that shows on this diagram a big difference between arteries and veins is this structure right here that we find only in veins. We also find structures like this in another part of the cardiovascular system. And what is that? That is the heart. The heart has valves. So veins have valves that prevent the retrograde flow of blood, right, from a more central region to an extremity. So blood and veins can only flow in one direction if these valves are healthy. And can you tell me what layer of a vein do these valves come from? Can you tell by this diagram? I'll be happy to tell you, but if you look at the color and the shape of this valve right here, what does it look like? It looks like endothelium, and indeed that is true. The endothelium makes valves and veins. And as a matter of fact, that's not too hard to remember because, remember, the heart valves are made from a layer of the heart. What layer of the heart are heart valves made from? The endocardium, right? The inner layer of the heart. So there's a similar kind, there's a nice analogy there. Okay. And you can see these valves in veins in people. Or for instance, the superficial veins in somebody's arm, if they lift up a heavy weight, all those muscles are going to be contracting and pressurizing the blood. Let me get control of the cursor here. Pressurizing the blood in veins. And if there's high pressure in this part of the vein and low pressure over here, blood is going to want to go backwards, right? And what's going to prevent it? This valve, right? And so blood is going to want to go back. It inflates this valve. There's high pressure right here. And you'll see that this part of the vein kind of blows up. And then here is a little knot in a blood vessel. And you'll see like a little node. And then a little bit farther away, you'll see another node, right? And it's just these valves that are inflating and preventing the retrograde flow of blood. You can see that in people. Little enlarged areas where these valves are attached to the endothelium. Okay, so make sure you know the layers within a blood vessel, and it's becoming very important because is there such a thing as vascular disease? Yes. Absolutely, okay? So here we're looking at some nice normal blood vessels, but they can degenerate. These veins right here can, under some circumstances, start to dilate, and as they get bigger, then these valves don't touch each other and they don't close. They just flop back and forth. And that produces peripheral vascular disease and varicose veins. So blood can flow to the heart or flow back down to an extremity. And if that's the case, maybe it's going to pool in some part of the body and form blood clots. And a blood clot in a blood vessel can cause a stroke or a heart attack, right? Or pulmonary embolism. And those are deadly events. So we monitor blood vessels all the time. In the carotid sinus, which we're going to look at in this chapter, right, is where there can be damage to the carotid artery, and it can form plaques within these various layers right here, and those plaques can break off and go to the brain and cause a stroke. Okay, so knowing these different layers is a way we can stage the disease that's happening in a particular blood vessel, and people are figuring out ways to actually insert a probe into an artery and make an image, a high-resolution image, and look at all of these different layers to see how the disease is progressing within the different layers. So that's really important for staging disease in the skin, staging disease in a blood vessel, or maybe disease in the alimentary canal, which has different layers too. We're going to look at the different layers of the digestive tract later on. Okay, so let's look at this word slide right here. You got arteries. Okay, takes blood away from the heart, maybe oxygenated or deoxygenated. You should have a name of an artery in your body that is oxygenated, right, or deoxygenated. We went over that. That has the highest pressure because blood is a fluid, and fluid will flow from high pressure to low pressure, right? So if your tire is low on pressure, how do you get air into it? You got to hook it up to a source that is higher pressure than the tire, and air is going to flow from that device, which is high pressure, into your tire, which is low. All right, so blood flows away from the heart, okay, because the heart has the highest pressure, and then it flows into an artery, And then capillaries have a little bit lower pressure, so then blood flows into a capillary. Blood flows from a capillary into a vein, because what can you tell me about the pressure inside a vein? Is it higher or lower than a capillary? It's got to be lower than a capillary, right? If pressure was lower in a capillary, then blood would flow from a vein into a capillary, and then it wouldn't get back to the heart. Okay, so the blood pressure is the lowest in veins. All right, different parts of your body, okay, transmit blood in a couple different ways. Large arteries close to the heart are what we call conducting arteries. They have a strong, smooth muscle layer, but they also have a lot of elastic tissue so that when the heart pumps, they can expand, and then when the heart relaxes, they go back to their normal size. We call those conducting arteries. Medium and small blood vessels far away from the heart, we call those distributing arteries. They still have a lot of smooth muscle, but not so much elastic tissue. They don't expand and contract very much when the heart contracts. But all of these do have smooth muscle, so they can constrict when that smooth muscle contracts, and they can dilate when that smooth muscle relaxes. Of course, that's under control of the autonomic nervous system. When those muscles relax, we call that vasodilation. And when they constrict, we call that vasoconstriction. And here is a really important physical property. The amount of flow through a tube, if we look at this tube right here, the amount of flow, if we keep the pressure high on one side and low on the other, where's my cursor? Right here. Right, if we keep the pressure the same, the flow through this tube is going to be determined by the radius of the tube, which is what? The radius is just twice the diameter of this tube, which is controlled by the degree of vasoconstriction or vasodilation. Small changes in vasoconstriction and vasodilation produces tremendous changes in blood flow through this tube right here. So let's take a look. We call it the fourth power rule. So let's just say that we have a radius of 1. Let's just say that here we have a tube with a radius of 1, and we measure the blood flow, and we're going to see that the blood flow is 1 unit of blood through this tube with a particular radius. Let's double the radius, okay? Actually, let's double the radius of this tube from 1 to 2, and look what happens to blood flow. You might expect that it's going to also go from 1 to 2, but how does it change? It goes to 16. How does it get to 16? That's a huge number compared to 2, right? Because of that fourth power rule. If we take 2 and multiply it by itself, what do we get? 2 times 2 is 4, all right? But it's the fourth power rule, not just the second power rule. So what do we got to do? We got to take 4 and multiply it by 2 again, and that's what? That's 8. But that's still not the fourth power rule. What do we got to do? Multiply it by 2 once again. So 2 times 8 is 16. So if the radius of a blood vessel changes by a factor of 2, what about blood flow through it? A factor of 16. There's a huge change. Or if the radius changes by a factor of 5, what about blood flow through it? It's 5 times 5 times 5 times 5, which is what? 625. So the way that your body regulates blood flow through various tissues is by changing the radius or the diameter of a blood vessel. It can drastically change the amount of blood flow through a particular organ. And you know what? You don't have enough blood in your body to go everywhere at one time. So your brain has to determine where it's going to go. Right? If you're just done eating a meal, then you need blood flow going to the digestive tract. In which case, then you don't have enough blood to go to muscles. So what did your mom always tell you right after lunch? You can't go swimming, because when you go swimming, what are you going to be using? Your skeletal muscles, and you don't have enough blood to go to your gastrointestinal tract and your skeletal muscles at the same time. Something bad could happen, like a muscle cramp or something like that, and you might not be able to hold your head above water, okay? All right, and so what controls where blood goes is what? Vasodilation or vasoconstriction of various blood vessels in your body. Okay. Arteries are large vessels. Arterioles are just small arteries. And they're especially specialized for regulating blood flow via vasodilation or vasoconstriction. In arteries, vasoconstriction and vasodilation is controlled by sympathetic nerves of the autonomic nervous system, but vasodilation and vasoconstriction of arterioles is not controlled by nerves, right? It's via what we call local control. And local control just means that there are compounds that build up in tissues, like for instance, when a muscle contracts, it's going to release lactic acid and acid into the surroundings around arterioles, and that's going to have an effect to dilate blood vessels that are feeding that muscle, because those muscles need more oxygen and nutrients to remain healthy. We call that local control. That's especially important for arterioles. And also, okay, for something, another smooth muscle that's in the capillary. Let me see if I can find another nice diagram of this. Oh, it's the very next one, right here. Okay, so here we have an artery, and here we have a little arteriole, and here's a capillary bed. A capillary bed is diagrammed as a network of little branches of blood vessels, and then here is a venule bringing blood to a vein. And here is a little gate at the entrance to each of these little capillaries, and it's a circular smooth muscle. We talked about circular smooth muscles in lab, except for one class that has lab this afternoon. But for those that have had lab already this week, what do we call a circular smooth muscle? A sphincter. Remember, a circular skeletal muscle is called orbicularis, but a circular smooth muscle is a sphincter, and when it contracts, it changes the diameter of this blood vessel and can cut off blood supply to this capillary bed right here. Okay, that's also under local control. So if this is an exercising muscle, it's going to release compounds that bind to receptors in the smooth muscle to cause it to relax. This blood vessel is going to dilate, and then you have a lot of blood flowing through this capillary right here, bringing nutrients and oxygen to the tissues. And it's also going to carry stuff away. What's it going to carry away from that exercising muscle? Like carbon dioxide, right? So carbon dioxide will have an effect to cause dilation of these precapillary sphincters. All right? And that process is what we call local control. So here we have a capillary. It doesn't look like it has any blood flowing through it. What could you tell me about the state of these smooth muscles right here? Are they contracted or relaxed? They're contracted, and when they contract, they cause what, vasodilation or vasoconstriction? Vasoconstriction. And when the radius of that blood vessel changes, what happens to blood flow when it vasoconstricts? It's reduced. It goes down. Okay. And then if that muscle were to start exercising, it's going to release CO2 and lactic acid, which is going to then inhibit these muscles. They're going to relax. And that's going to produce what? Vasoconstriction or vasodilation? Vasodilation. What's going to happen to blood flow then when these vasodilate? It's going to increase, and it's going to bring oxygen and wash away the CO2 and lactic acid, and it's going to maintain the health of those muscles. That process we call local control because it doesn't require innervation, doesn't require a nerve. Okay. All right, so these are all capillaries that we're looking at. Capillaries are the smallest blood vessels. And what about pressure, blood pressure? Is blood pressure the lowest in a capillary? And the answer is, and you'll have to think about it, is no. Because if blood pressure were lowest in the capillaries, blood would flow from arteries into capillaries, which is a good thing, but blood would also flow from veins into capillaries, and if that were to happen, it would never flow back to the heart. Right? So capillaries still have some blood pressure, but the lowest is in veins. Okay. Three kinds of capillaries. And it all depends on how leaky they are. Okay. And some capillaries are a little bit leaky, which is okay because what happens in the capillary? In one word, exchange. So we would expect capillaries to be able to lose some fluid and other kinds of compounds. Okay. And depending on what part of the body it is, capillaries should be more leaky than in other parts. So here is the kind of capillary which is the least leaky, right? It allows for exchange because it has clefts between the cells that make up the endothelium. So here I see an endothelial cell, and here's a space between the next endothelial cell. So fluid and other small molecules can leak out through this intercellular cleft pretty easily. So it's leakier than a vein or an artery. Okay, so here's another intercellular cleft. These cells are still joined together with tight junctions, but you still have these spaces between them. But there are no pores within the endothelial cell. Fluid can only leak out through these intracellular clefts. And that's a continuous capillary. The next kind of capillary has these pores within the endothelial cell. And so that just allows more material to leak out. We call this a fenestrated capillary. Right? And so we find these, for instance, in the kidney that need to be filtering a lot of blood to keep blood clean. So here are these pores. It still has intracellular clefts that allows for leak. Okay, but the leakiest kind of capillary is this one right here. And probably you can see it. It has very large intercellular clefts and very large pores. So blood in this kind of capillary, it just profusely leaks out. These pores aren't big enough so that the red blood cells can actually move through, but the plasma, the fluid part, and large molecules can leak out. This is what we call a sinusoidal capillary. And we find these in the liver in particular. And one of the jobs of the liver is to clean blood, because a lot of blood leaks out through a capillary and it filters through the different spaces in a liver. We call those sinusoids within a liver. So this is a sinusoidal. All right, so you got to know which one is the least leaky. It is the continuous capillary, right? And the intermediate form is the fenestrated. You could think of a fenestration as like a little window in the endothelial cell. And the most leaky is a sinusoidal type of capillary. Okay, then blood from a capillary. Capillaries joined together. We call that anastomosis, where one capillary joins another. Let's see, let me go back a couple pictures. Okay, so here I see capillaries joining together. When blood vessels join together, we call that anastomosis. And here's a capillary joining another one. This is an anastomosis, right? So that these capillaries come together to form a venule, which is a little tiny vein, and then small veins join together making a bigger vein. What do we call it when small veins join together to make a bigger vein? It's not on this list right here. That is also an anastomosis. Oh, so I want to go over that. So when think of blood flow is going in this direction. So as blood joins together, because blood vessels come together, we call that an anastomosis. But if we look at the other end of a capillary, okay, blood is flowing in this direction and some blood goes over here and some goes over here. It splits. That splitting is what we call a bifurcation. So a bifurcation is the opposite of an anastomosis. So arteries and arterioles bifurcate, venules and veins anastomose. They join together. That's the big difference. All right, so remember, a vein brings blood back to the heart. It may be oxygenated or deoxygenated blood. You should probably have an example of either of each on the tip of your tongue. Like, for instance, the vena cava is what? Oxygenated or deoxygenated? Deoxygenated. Pulmonary vein is what? Pulmonary vein is oxygenated because it's coming back from the lungs, right? And that's the same thing as the umbilical vein, for those of you that have lab this week already. All right, and veins have the lowest blood pressure. So those don't have to be very strong blood vessels because the pressure is really low. And the strange thing about veins is that they have something that no other vessel has, and that is a valve. Because they're so low blood pressure, sometimes blood wants to flow back to an extremity and not toward the heart, but it can't because of those valves right there. Okay, so how does blood flow back to the heart? There are two particular pumps that are important for maintaining blood flow back to the heart. Oh, this is the very next slide. So here I have a blood vessel, okay, and don't be tricked because it's blue, because blue could be an artery or a vein, right, depending on what circulation it is, all right, but you should be able to tell me by the structure right here if this is an artery or a vein. How do you know if this is an artery or a vein, and why? I see valves. Yeah, perfect. And if it has valves, then it's got to be a vein, okay? So here is a vein, and I can see valves periodically positioned on this vein. There's going to be some valves down over here. And let's just say that this is a vein in your leg, and you're walking around. And what do you need to do to walk around? You need to contract muscles, right? You need to contract muscles. And what happens when you contract a muscle, like I'm demonstrating right here? I'm almost ripping my shirt. What do? They bulge, right? They bulge, right? And so here we have a couple bulging muscles on either side of this vein. And when they bulge, they compress the blood in this vein right here. They make very high pressure. Like if you squeeze down on a balloon, what happens to the pressure in that balloon? It increases, right? And if you squeeze down really hard, enough pressure to pop the balloon, okay? So when these muscles contract, they compress this vein and pressurize the blood. And so blood is going to want to flow from high pressure, this area that's being compressed, to low pressure that's on either side of these valves right here. So there's low pressure where the cursor is, high pressure right here. So guess which way blood wants to go? If there's high pressure here and low pressure here, it will want to go in the reverse direction, away from the heart, which is what? Not the proper direction. But there's something that's going to stop it. And what is that thing that's going to stop it from going? This valve right here, right? And it's going to expand. Superficial veins, you'll be able to see that expansion, for instance, in your arms and legs. And if there's high pressure here and low pressure in this segment, guess which way blood is going to go? From this segment that's being pressurized back up to this segment right here, which is what? Now closer to the heart. So this is what we call the skeletal muscle pump. Whenever you contract muscles in your body, that helps the return of blood flow to your heart. And that is really a good thing, because you never want to have blood moving backwards in your body, or even worse yet, staying in a particular location, because then it's going to lose its liquid property and become a solid and form a blood clot. All right, so activity, muscle activity is important for just maintaining the health of your circulatory system, because it keeps blood in a nice fluid condition. All right, so if you're going to hop on a plane and take a 16-hour plane flight someplace, where do you have to go to fly in an airplane for 16 hours? Southeast Asia. Indonesia, for instance. Maybe you're going to go to Denpasar over the summer or something. Do some surfing. Okay, and you sit in an airplane for a long period of time. Okay, what can happen is, and it does happen to people every once in a while, they'll have a blood clot, and then it's going to break away and travel to the heart, the right side of the heart, into the right ventricle. The right ventricle pumps blood into what circulation? The right ventricle into the pulmonary circulation, right? And so when it gets into that artery, what do arteries do? Do they anastomose or do they bifurcate? They bifurcate, and when they bifurcate, the arteries get what? Smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually that particle gets trapped, and what organ is it in? If it's in the pulmonary circulation, the lungs, right? And so it blocks off blood supply to a part of the lungs, it kills that part of the lung, we call that pulmonary embolism, and that usually is fatal when that happens. Okay, so what should you do? Just not sit still for long periods of time, but get up, walk around, get this skeletal muscle pump activated so that blood flows back to the heart, that completes your circulatory system, right? That's one important thing. There was a news reporter. There was in the very first war in Iraq, I guess that was Desert Storm, he was too concerned for his own safety to leave a Humvee, which was an armored vehicle. And he sat in a Humvee for, I think, about 3 days and didn't move. And guess what happened? His blood wasn't circulating properly. It formed an embolism. It formed a thrombus that went to the lungs that caused a pulmonary embolism, and he died as a result of that. I forget his name. He's a pretty famous news reporter. Huh? That's some irony, because you think you're safe in the Humvee, but that activity was actually causing his death. Yeah, so that is a perfect example of irony. That's nice. Irony is what? A literary form of thinking and speaking, right? We're going to talk about irony in this class, too, in the very last chapter. Okay, so skeletal muscle pump, I want you to know. There's something else, too, that pumps blood, helps blood return to the heart. Okay, and, oh, I don't have a picture of it. Okay, but this might be a pretty good example. Here I see the pulmonary circulation. Okay, so remember, a fluid will flow because of a pressure difference. So, and what's the pressure difference? How is a fluid going to flow? From high pressure to low pressure, right? Okay, and air is a fluid as well. Air is not a solid, it's a fluid. It's going to flow from high pressure to low pressure, and that's how wind is made and things like that. Okay, so how do we get air in and out of our lungs? By breathing, by changing pressure of our thoracic cavity. All right, so in order to inhale, we have to expand our thoracic cavity by contraction of the diaphragm. It makes our thoracic cavity bigger. And as the cavity gets bigger, the pressure decreases inside of it. So now you have low pressure in your thorax, regular pressure in the atmosphere, in the air. Which way is air going to flow when your thoracic cavity expands and the pressure decreases? Air is going to flow in as a result of that. Okay. And then how does air flow out? Decrease the size of the thoracic cavity. Like if you decrease the size of a balloon, what happens to the pressure inside that balloon? It goes way up, right? So if you decrease the size of your thoracic cavity, then air is going to flow out of your lungs because of pressure changes inside the thorax. But not just air, right? If you decrease the pressure of your thorax, that will also not only suck air into your lungs, but it will also suck blood into your thoracic cavity. And what's in your thoracic cavity that is going to be receiving that blood? That's the heart. Okay, so breathing also returns blood to your heart. Inhalation brings blood back to your heart. We call that the respiratory pump. So there are two pumps that help return blood to your heart. One is the skeletal muscle pump right here, and the other is the respiratory pump. Just the act of breathing returns blood to the heart. Okay. All right, so now we get to actually look at some anatomy. The two circulations, you know, pulmonary and systemic. And here we see the pulmonary circulation in some really nice detail. The state of blood is relatively deoxygenated, so it's blue, but here is a vessel taking blood away from the heart. This is the pulmonary, what is this right here? Pulmonary artery taking blood away from the heart. We see that it bifurcates very early on, okay, to the left pulmonary artery taking blood to the left lung, and here's the right pulmonary artery taking blood to the right lung. And then there are pulmonary capillaries in here that allow for exchange so that when blood flows back to the heart after those capillaries, right, what do we call these blood vessels that are bringing blood back to the heart? Veins. These are pulmonary veins, and they're nicely color-coded bright red because they are now oxygenated, highly oxygenated because they're returning from the lung. So this is the pulmonary circulation. And where in the heart do these pulmonary veins deliver blood to? What chamber in particular is what I'm kind of thinking of? Yeah, the left atrium. So it's the left side of the heart, which is what? The beginning of the systemic circulation. That's the end of the pulmonary circulation and the beginning of the systemic circulation. So when the left ventricle pumps blood into the aorta, which is an artery, right, it's color-coded nice bright red because it's taking oxygenated blood to the systemic circulation. So here is an example of a capillary in the lungs. These little spherical structures are little air sacs. We call these alveoli that are filled with air. And so there's high oxygen in this alveolus. And that oxygen can move by diffusion from high concentration to low concentration that's in the blood. And it can get into this capillary because, what can you tell me about the wall of this capillary? It's really thin, right? It only has an endothelium. So oxygen can enter. Here you have high carbon dioxide in the blood, low carbon dioxide in the air of this alveolus, so carbon dioxide just moves by diffusion from high concentration to low. So just use that same model in your mind for how a fluid flows because of pressure. It could be, right, it always goes from high to low, high pressure to low pressure, or high concentration to low concentration if it's diffusion, for instance. All right, so that's the pulmonary circulation. Systemic circulation. What kind of nice pictures do you have? You're kind of familiar with the systemic circulation already. A couple details I want to talk about. You're familiar with the heart, so let's zoom in. Can we zoom into the heart? Let's start right here. So here I have the aorta, So that's a dead giveaway. We're looking at which circulation, systemic or pulmonary? Yeah, systemic circulation, right? Because I don't see the pulmonary artery. Of course, you all have a pulmonary artery. It's just not on this diagram, right? So that simply we can see the arch, right? But don't forget that the most anterior great vessel coming off the base of the heart is the pulmonary artery. Then it bifurcates underneath the arch of the aorta. All right, so here we have the aorta. And it makes a nice hairpin turn right here. That's what we call the arch. That's not the first division of the aorta. What is the first division of the aorta? The ascending aorta. Indeed, here I see the ascending aorta, and then the arch, and then the descending aorta. And I want to show you some more of the descending aorta. All right, so from here to here is the descending aorta, and the descending aorta has two main divisions, depending on what body cavity it's in, right? If it's in the abdominal cavity, we call it the abdominal division of the descending aorta. If it is superior to the diaphragm, say from here to here, then this is going to be the thoracic division of the descending aorta, okay? And this is really important to know because there's super high pressure in the aorta, and when it becomes diseased, it can fracture, right? And it can blow up, and ooh, you can die like instantaneously when that happens. Who died of that not too long ago? Famous actor. I always forget his name. He was in Family Ties. I can remember the show. I never watched the show. Oh, John Ritter? John Ritter. I always say Bruce Ritter. No, but he's the athlete. John Ritter. Okay. There are certain conditions called Marfan's disease, which is a connective tissue disease, which produces blood vessels that are not very strong, okay, because they don't have collagen in them. People with Marfan's disease are susceptible to rips in the aorta. We call that dissection, and then aneurysms and bursting of the aorta. Okay, and people that are, and it's really easy usually to tell somebody with Marfan syndrome, and so they're just followed with ultrasounds and MRI images to make sure that their cardiovascular system is okay, just routine scans to check so they don't have to die suddenly. All right, so off the ascending aorta, we have a couple branches of arteries that bring blood to the heart. What do we call the circulation? It's a subset of the systemic circulation that brings blood to the heart. What kind of circulation is that? Y'all know. It's called the coronary circulation. Coronary blood vessels that bring blood to the heart. That's a part of the systemic circulation. So there are two coronary blood vessels that come off the ascending aorta. Do you remember the names of those? It's not, I can see them on the slide, but they're not labeled. They're the left coronary artery and the right coronary artery. Because remember, how many circulations are there? Two. How many sides of the heart are there? Two. And you got two coronary arteries that supply those two sides of the heart, the left coronary and right coronary. That comes off the ascending aorta. Then you've got the arch. And I see three blood vessels coming off the arch of the aorta. And I think you had to know this already. Those are the brachiocephalic, taking blood to the right side of the head and the right upper appendage, hence its name. Brachio means arm, cephalic means head. The second branch, actually the second and third branch are doing the job together of what the first branch does. So the second branch right here takes blood to the head, all right, but the left side of the head, not the right side. That's what we call the common carotid. And then the third branch off the arch of the aorta is the left subclavian. So left common carotid, left subclavian. Getting back to the brachiocephalic trunk right here, we see that very early on it branches into what? The right common carotid and the right subclavian. Okay, so you can see some asymmetry as well as some symmetry in this diagram. All right, the subclavian just means it goes right underneath the clavicle. Typically, when you break a clavicle, do you have to worry about lacerating that subclavian artery right there? Okay? That would be a terrible thing. You could bleed to death really fast if that were to happen. But because of the clavicle has that funny shape, it kind of looks like an S, it always, what, breaks to the outside. It never breaks deep. That's how it was evolved, because when people had bones that weren't formed that way, right, when they broke their clavicle, which is pretty easy to do, it would lacerate the subclavian, and they would then bleed to death, and then what would happen? Okay, if they bleed to death, then they have very low reproductive potential, right, if you're dead. So that shape of the bone was selected by evolutionary processes. All right, the subclavian then just turns into the axillary artery in the armpit region, and the axilla, the axillary artery becomes the brachial, and then it bifurcates in the forearm into the radial and ulnar, and then we see the plexus of blood vessels here in the hand. We call that, right, the palmar arches, so that if one blood vessel or the other, either the medial or lateral side of the arm, that whole side of the arm doesn't die because blood can flow back up. It can take an alternate route to get to the other side of the arm. All right, so that's kind of a nice review from lab. What other things do I see on this picture right here? We might have some better pictures in the book, but let's zoom into this region right here. Okay, let's look at the brachiocephalic. We can see it bifurcating into the common carotid and the subclavian on the right side of the body. Let's continue up the common carotid. It's going to bifurcate, right? If we have a name of a blood vessel with common part of the name, that means that it's going to bifurcate, or maybe it will anastomose if it's a vein. Okay, so the common carotid is going to bifurcate to the external carotid and an internal carotid. Internal carotid is probably the most important vessel bringing blood to the brain, which of course you all know is really important. The external brings blood to structures that are external to the cranium, outside the skull. Okay, the face and the scalp and things of that nature. This junction right here between the common carotid and the internal and external, you should write that down. I have it on your lab list right here. It's called the carotid sinus. And it's sort of, it forms a little bulge right here. And inside that bulge are pressure receptors. So this is one of the main areas where your body knows what kind of blood pressure you have. So for instance, when you stand up after sitting, listening to a really long lecture, and maybe even falling asleep a little bit, your blood pressure is a little bit low because you're relaxed, and you stand up, when you change body position, your blood pressure is going to drop even more. All right, and when your blood pressure drops, there might not be enough pressure to bring it up to the brain right here. What's going to happen to the brain if blood isn't getting to it? Yeah, you're going to go unconscious. You're going to lose consciousness or feel a little woozy if you don't lose consciousness. Okay, so these blood pressure sensors right here will say, oh, gee whiz, your blood pressure is dropping. Okay, we better do something to make sure your blood pressure doesn't drop so low that you lose consciousness. Because if you do and you're standing, then your head is going to hit the table and bounce off the table, and then it's going to hit the chair and bounce off the chair, and then it's going to hit the floor and bounce around on the floor. None of those things are good, right? So what are these pressure sensors going to do? What are they going to tell your body to do to get blood pressure back up? They're going to send signals to the brain. The brain is going to say, we better send some signals to the heart, increase the rate of contraction of your heart, force of contraction that will increase your blood pressure back to where it should be in a normal circumstance. So the carotid sinus is very important in that reason, right? It helps maintain blood pressure in the short term so you don't pass out. The other thing is that because of this bulge right here, it actually forms plaques. The walls of the arteries that become diseased very early compared to other parts of your blood vessels. And of course, if there's a plaque that breaks off, where is it going to go? Right to the brain, causing a stroke. Okay, so this is one of the most frequently and most commonly imaged areas in the human body because they're looking for vascular disease to help prevent strokes or transient ischemic attacks where people lose consciousness. All right, so ultrasound is particularly useful of looking at the carotid sinus for looking at disease between the various layers of those blood vessels right there. All right, so I do want you to know carotid sinus. So I think we've talked about all these blood vessels right here. Yeah, we did. Thoracic aorta. Well, we got visceral arteries to thoracic organs, and we got parietal arteries that go to the muscles of the chest wall. Like, what kind of muscles are in the chest wall? Like the intercostals, right? External intercostals. Okay, abdominal aorta. All right, so we're done with the thoracic aorta, but we're still with the descending aorta. Okay, in the abdominal cavity, sometimes you have two organs. They come in pairs. Like here I see some kidneys. You got one on the right, one on the left. So sometimes you got two. What's another organ that you have two of? I know we're not really done with anatomy yet, but maybe you might know that you have other organs that you have pairs of. Okay, yeah, like gonads, for instance. You have two ovaries. Ovary on one side, not everybody, but you have an ovary on the right, you got one on the left. Another gonad will be a testes, right? You might have one on the left, one on the right under normal circumstances. So since you have one on the right and one on the left, you have a pair of blood vessels leaving the descending aorta, right? So we want to break branches off the aorta into branches that come in pairs that go to organs that you have two of versus unpaired branches, blood vessels that go to organs that you only have one of. Does anybody know an organ you have in your abdominal cavity that you only have one of? Liver. You got one liver. You only have one branch going to it. You don't have a right and left hepatic artery. You just have one artery going to it. Stomach. You only have one stomach. Okay? So the way to simplify understanding branches off the abdominal aorta is to classify them as an unpaired branch or a paired branch. All right, let's look at these paired branches first. The renal artery. Anytime you hear renal, you should think of kidney. Here's a nice renal artery. And here's another kidney over here. Here is the right renal artery. It comes off as a pair, right? A branched pair. All right, so that is the first. All right, there's also one not shown on this diagram that goes to the adrenal gland. It's above the kidney. There are adrenal arteries that go to each, the right and left adrenal gland. That's a branched pair. All right, and then here is another branched pair right here. These are going to go to either ovaries or testes, and those are what we call gonads. So these are the gonadal arteries, left gonadal artery, right gonadal artery. Okay. These other branches that you see here, here, and here, these are unpaired branches. They go to organs that you only have one of, like small intestine, large intestine. All right, so those organs are surrounded by mesenteries. And so these arteries here and here are named mesenteric arteries. When we do a fetal pig dissection, we'll look at mesentery that surround the intestine, and you're going to see them loaded with blood vessels. This one is above this one, so this one here is called the superior mesenteric artery, and this is the inferior mesenteric artery. Not too hard to know. This one here looks a little bit complicated, and it's got its own special name. It's called the celiac trunk, celiac artery, because it bifurcates very early on into an artery that goes to the spleen, and then we call that the splenic artery. And then it bifurcates some more, and it goes to the stomach. We call that the gastric artery. And it bifurcates some more, goes to the liver. We call that hepatic artery. So the celiac trunk, right, is an unpaired branch that brings blood to the spleen, parts of the small intestine, okay, the stomach, and the liver. So if you look at these things right here in terms of paired and unpaired branches, it makes looking at this mess of arteries pretty easy, actually, I think. Maybe not for you guys. All right, in lab, what else did we know? After the Wow. It's time for the weekend. That might even be a little bit better than talking about these cool iliac arteries right here. So, guess what? So I'm going to stop talking. And make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And, oh, what else? Oh, next week. What's happening next week? I forgot to mention this. Oh, I don't have the schedule up. But don't forget, Monday is a lecture, but Wednesday is an exam. But this chapter, I don't believe, is on the exam. I think it stops at heart. So you got to learn your nervous system and heart. Okay, but this is on the practicum for today, right? All right, so have a nice weekend, you guys. But I would start preparing for that lecture exam next week, maybe tonight. It's exam number 4, but we also have an exam during finals week, which is going to be the last exam. But let me turn this recorder off.